Hey, everybody. Happy Tuesday. It's 8 p.m. and you're checking out the Revolution Radio Network. That means it's time for the Idavox Report.
Hello, everybody. This is Dynamon Jenkins. That's why from, that's why I haven't said that since Dynamon Jenkins from One People's Project, and I'm here with Ryan Powers and Christian Perez for the Idavox Report for today, March 9th, 2021. A really nice day down here today in good old New Jersey. What's up, Punk's Progress? I'm glad everybody is here today. And Leah's in the background. We're showing love. What's up, Leah? And she's waving. No one can see her, but trust me, she's sending her love back. This has been a rather eventful week. No, Brian, we are not talking about yesterday's events. But unless we are in fact talking, I mean, I and Christian, I'm definitely not talking about the royal family.
Oh, come on! You don't want to dirt on them a little bit, just a little bit.
Well, they do run the government, you know.
Yeah, right.
No. I guess no. I think our government here is a big problem, and I think we need to address what's going on in our local locales, so to speak. We just got word. We're getting word like tomorrow the COVID bill is supposed to be passed. And we'll start getting a little bit of relief from that. Would have been even nicer if we can get relief from with $15 minimum wage hike. But
even Democrats
kill the bill.
$15 ain't shit. We were asking for $15 an hour in 2011.
We didn't get it.
We still ain't got it. The parliamentarians. Hey, parliamentarians' fault.
I say we ask for 65 minimum wage. Yeah, I say we ask for 65 and see if
abolish the wage system. Just get rid of it.
Well, that's all that will work too. We can go right on the trash sheet with the police.
I don't understand how an hour of Jeff Bezos' life is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, and mine seems to be worth some stems and seeds. I mean, you know.
I'm not you don't want to put that one out there. World,
but that disparity is a little bit. Yeah. I'm done with the wage system. I have been for quite some time.
You see, the reason why, here's the thing. There's a lot of people. Remember, you said 10 years ago, we're going to be coming up on the 10th anniversary. I think we just lost our guest. We're going to be up on the 10th anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street in October. And, it was that basically said, basically told people that we are in control of our own destinies, you know, and we don't have to rely on a corrupt political process to find solutions to our problems. As a matter of fact, it was that corrupt political process that took down Occupy, and then they started promoting themselves as being the champions for Fight for 15. And what do we get? 10 years later, we get those same people. Oh no, they didn't do it like this. They did it like,
yeah. And you fight for 15. Now that was SCIU, and I don't know if he was still there at the time, but that was the Andy Stern model of unionism, which really kind of dominates unions today as far as the larger unions. And Andy Stern's one of the greatest bastards of all time. What he basically did was he would go to an employer first. He didn't organize the workers at all. I had nothing to do with it. Workers had the last thing to do with the union, right? There you go. Oh, why unions matter. All right, so yeah, read a book called You Have Nothing to Lose But Your Chains by Ray O'Light. And it tells you Andy Stern would go to, but instead, you know, normally you go to the workers and they would form the union. No, Andy Stern would go to the bosses first and say, if you let us form a union, we'll give you a nice contract. You can screw them on health benefits. You can give them maybe a 1% raise every year, just as long as we get the dues money and you and I can have martinis and get hookers once a week. And that was how Andy Stern basically expanded SEIU's ranks so big. Nowadays, Andy Stern is a member of an anti-union nonprofit. Just so you know. He's a really great guy, and I hope he dies slowly and rots somewhere.
Well, see, look, it's all about I'll go back to saying it before. It's all about us making sure that we have control of our communities and our development. And we always have had that control. We just got to recognize it. I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have our guest on today, because one of the things that we have been talking about over the past couple of weeks is the crisis in Texas after the winter storm that they had there and how it just devastated the state. They're still trying to recover from that. Unfortunately, they have a lousy governor there. They also have a lousy governor in Mississippi. But no one's really talking about him, and nobody's really talking about the situation that's going on in Mississippi. And we're going to bring someone on who's talking about and trying to get the story out about the crisis, the water crisis that's happening, particularly in Jackson, Mississippi. And her name, and I apologize because I asked her how to pronounce her name before. Calendra Davis, organizer with BYP 100. I hope she can come on. Are you there?
Yes. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. We can hear you fine. And you're out of Jackson, Mississippi. And did I say your name correctly?
It's Calendra.
Calendra. I apologize. Mm-hmm. I really do apologize. I wanted to make sure I got it right before I got on air, but it escaped me.
Fine.
It's okay. So one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on in particular, because you know the way we came across each other was because I was dealing with some Antifa from out of Mississippi. Yes, a rare breed. And I wanted to have somebody from down in Mississippi to come on and talk about what's been going on in their state in relation to fighting fascism, fighting racism and such. And this particular crisis it's unfortunate that we are not talking about it as much as we should. And as the Daily Beast wrote something about it, we're gonna put a link up to that story in a few minutes. Calendra is one of the people that is fighting for that, fighting to see a resolution to that. So I want to welcome you to the show, and I want to ask, in a nutshell, what's going on down your way?
Yeah. So first, I want to apologize because I'm actually out and about. Got to pick up my daughter soon. But so in case you guys hear, you know, background noise. And then secondly, so Jackson, very similar to Texas, or I would say Mississippi as a whole, you know, experienced a snow or a winter storm a few weeks ago. As a result of that storm, then there was ice, the city, the state shut down for a while. And I would say that storm on top of the pandemic, on top of systemic racism, has been really, really just affecting people in a very negative way. It's now we're without water. So one crisis turned into another crisis. And it basically compounded the economic crisis that we were already in. So folks, many, especially in Jackson, Mississippi, people are going on their fourth week without clean water. There are still a few people with no water at all. And those folks are really in like the pockets of the city that are, one, hardest hit by COVID, and then two, that are majority Black and brown. And that's it. And you have people who are on the ground who are responding to this crisis because our elected officials are not doing so.
Like, who in particular are the elected officials that are in the way? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, I would say, one, this is a decades old issue, but our current elected officials, Governor Tate Reeves, did not declare a state of emergency in a timely manner to where, in comparison to Texas, where they were able to assess federal relief. Especially like vouchers, food vouchers for those who lost food because they were without power. Mississippians did not have access to that. Again, because our governor did not I did not declare the state of emergency. And then on a local level, we have, our mayor and city council. I will say they have been out helping get water to people, but that only goes so far. And we know we need, right now, getting water to people is charity, and we need something beyond that. People are still getting water bills. And so officials on a local level could really step up to make sure that folks aren't having to pay thousands in water bills for water that's not even clean or water that they can't use.
Now, like I was saying before, we sometimes have to just take matters into our own hands whenever we have our elected officials not stepping up to the plate, so to speak. Can you tell us what kind of efforts are being made in the grassroots level? What kind of mutual aid organizations and what kind of relief efforts have been basically put in place by, the residents, by citizens of Jackson or what have you? Hello?
Yes, sorry, my mic was muted. there has been a collective effort, many different organizations and people who have come together, one, to get clean water, whether that's potable water for people to use to flush or bathe with, or bottled drinking water. And also a lot of these efforts are on part because are happening because we were able to receive funding from the Movement for Black Lives in the Southern Power Fund. And so we were able to distribute those funds across the state so people could respond directly. Those who are on the ground and who live in the communities could respond directly to what's happening in the communities. We have also been able to provide hot meals and then food boxes with fresh food from local farms and non-perishable foods. We have been able to shelter or put over 80 people in two hotel rooms who were either did not have access to power or water, or when the power came back on, they still didn't have access to clean water or water or no water at all. And they needed water, especially those elderly and those with small children. And then we have also been able to provide direct payments to people, especially those who were like, this storm has really, really caused a lot. So bursted pipes, utility bills that are in $1,800, $1,600. And so we have been able to help somewhat, still not enough. There's definitely more needed, but we've been able to help a little.
And we're going to start off, and I know Chris, sounds like Christian has a question right quick.
Yeah, I've got a quick question.
Go ahead and do it.
Okay. Calandra, like I want to talk to you about these direct payments that you made to some families, because a lot of the rhetoric we hear coming from the far right is that you just can't give people money, especially poor people, especially poor Black people. You can't just give them money because they'll spend it on who knows what. They'll be irresponsible. Can you speak to what the reaction has been to the direct payments to some of the families that have received them?
Yes. So I will say that, again, that this snowstorm really just compounded the economic crisis that we were already in. And for a lot of communities in Mississippi, they were in the economic crisis again before the coronavirus. And so this is, three different economic crises that folks are having to deal with, which right now we're seeing that Mississippi is one of the highest states facing evictions. And so right now, when people are calling, we have a hotline. The hotline is paused, but when the hotline is open, we received a lot of phone calls. People were almost hesitant to ask for help in some cases. When we did give direct payments out, and folks were like, okay, we have water now. How can we send something back? And so I would say that Mississippians, and I'm sure this is true for communities across the nation, but we look out for each other. And so even when we are going through, as I mentioned, some of our volunteers are still without water. and they haven't asked for a direct payment, but we know that people need money and resources in order to, one, do this work, and also in order just to survive. And so we have people who have received payments and then have turned around and wanted to donate or help out in some kind of way. Wow. Or if they did not, you know, weren't able to donate financially, they wanted to show up and give their time or their talent to help push these efforts forward.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that speaks to everything Daryl was saying. I mean, if in the absence of government, we have to come together, these communities have to come together and address these problems.
I had a question because you mentioned, of course, systemic racism and all these kinds of problems coming together around it. And we've talked to people from different Gulf Coast states that have experienced this combination of both systemic racism, economic kind of turmoil, as well as the environment that you live in, you know, where hurricanes go and where there's oil trade is, you know, a big thing in that. Are you finding yourself when you're organizing, are you finding yourself having commonality of interest on a larger scale with these other, you know, kind of Gulf Coast communities?
I would say definitely so. I actually was a little late joining this call because I was on a call with others across the South, from some folks from Florida, folks from Louisiana, who are all having the same conversations right now because of the environmental racism that we're experiencing.
And how do those conversations go? Because we're getting into the warmer weather, and a lot of situations are going to start coming up with that warmer weather. So what were people saying on that call? Are you able to say what was on that call, and what kind of concerns from us outside of the South? What kind of thing? How can people outside of the South can help you out?
One part of the conversation was that this isn't a one-time weather event, that it will likely happen again. Climate change, all of that is not going anywhere. So we just want to make sure that we respond to this and that our response is sustainable and that we're strategic about it. And so the best way to do that is to be in collaboration with folks who understand, one, what's going on, but also people who can kind of tell us the best ways to respond, again, in a sustainable way.
Okay. And it's interesting, too, because I was making the joke earlier about how Antifa in Mississippi is a rare breed. But I was actually responded. It was in regards to the fact that, you know, Mississippi, you don't hear a lot about, I should say, for lack of a better term, progressive politics. You don't hear a lot about people actually trying to come up in Jackson, for example. Jackson seems to be this oasis of activity that's surrounded by an ocean, a desert of rather radical, or for lack of a better term, traditionalist ideas, traditional as far as Mississippi is concerned. Is it tough to navigate? How tough is it to navigate those waters? Is it just Jackson that you can find some sort of relief from all the other things that you see coming out of other parts of the state? I was actually doing a TV show in Tupelo probably about four years ago. And it basically, Tupelo was a quiet town, but you listen to the radio down there and there's a lot of anti-union commercials and things like that. I was there trying to deal with the Klan.
It's as if the white supremacist power structure in Mississippi is intent on making them suffer. It's not political power in the 1950s, and they haven't gotten over it in the city of Jackson. And it's a problem that we see repeated throughout the United States, and the South gets a large brunt of it, but it's not just the South.
Yeah, and saying that it's a white supremacist power structure in Mississippi is not hyperbole. I mean, we've had several governors and several politicians that will be associated with the Council of Conservative Citizens, including Haley Barbour, who would attend their events. I would probably have to look and see whether or not this current governor has any associations with them. But we do know that that problem exists. That problem exists. But here's the thing. The other problem, this problem that we're talking about right now, when Flint happened, when we was talking about the water in Flint, and when that came up, that really did open up the fact that we was all having problems with the water all over the country. We started talking about Newark, and I think Gary, Indiana came up. And
40% of the Navajo Nation doesn't have access to running water.
Exactly. So is this, would you say, something that, like you said, we've been talking about this for a while, and do you say that? Would you say that the current situation with the storm pretty much just exposed that, at least locally, for everyone to see and for everyone to talk about?
I would definitely say that the storm. Yeah, I've talked to quite a few people, and people have made the comparisons to Flint, Michigan. And I would say, yeah, the storm, you know, maybe at one point we thought that it was an isolated incident in Flint, that it was just poor decision making, and that was it. I think the storm has shown that that's not the case. That, as you mentioned, it's definitely a problem across the nation. And we continuously see, like, which communities are most impacted.
And do you say that, you made reference to this earlier. Do you feel that it's been pretty intentional, the fact that the state government in particular has been ignoring this problem going on in Jackson?
Yes, I definitely think it's intentional. I don't know if you all are aware, but our governor recently somewhat tried to make a deal to say that the state could give the city of Jackson $30 million if the city of Jackson would give up control of the international airport here that we have in the city. And so if we gave the state control of the airport, the state would help people out with clean water. It almost seems as if they're playing a game with people's livelihoods at this point. So I can't help but to think that it's intentional. Their response is intentional.
And just so we're clear, Jackson, Mississippi is the capital, correct?
Yes, Jackson is the capital.
So I have to say, we see the same thing happening in Camden, New Jersey, in Detroit, where you have cities that are predominantly black, black run, majority black population that are facing all kinds of problems with underfunding. And rather than the result of state and federal government be giving them aid, it seems to come in, take over, and then take apart the town. We saw it in Detroit breaking down radio stations, in Camden giving away a number of properties. But if I'm not mistaken, I believe in Jackson, the airport is one of the few revenue generators that you have in that area. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Yes. I mean, this would mean a complete takeover. Like, again, this is a lack of aid. This is not them giving you help. This is them coming in and saying, oh, we'll just buy this, because I don't see salvation coming from giving control of the airport away. It's frustrating. I can't imagine what you're going through down there in Mississippi.
Come on in, Brian.
Yeah, I guess like every other, you know, activist, I mean, I could tell, like, right now you're involved. You said you're grabbing your daughter while you're talking to us right after a conference call that you're on, and not, it doesn't seem that many of us sleep. You know, I was just wondering, like, how I mean, you clearly have a lot on your plate, comrade, and I appreciate what you're doing for the greater good. But how do you deal with it as an activist? Do you take downtime? How are you coping mentally with all the work that you do as an activist on these serious issues?
That is a great question. And I do not have the answer. I will say that there are people in my circle, or people who are doing the work, that reminds all of us that it's okay to rest, which I completely agree with, but it's easier said than done. So, you know, and I'm a single mom. So if I'm at home and I'm helping my daughter with her homework, but then someone calls and says, you know, we need a room and we don't have anywhere else to go, then it's kind of like I have to balance the two. And I know I'm not the only one. We have people who are still without water, who are volunteering and distributing water and doing a lot. And then we have folks who are really like talking. We're sitting down and saying, how can we do some sustainable work and be really strategic about what it is that we're doing so we can make a larger impact. And that's not something that happens overnight. So we don't, you know, just drop off water and it's done and we don't have to worry about it anymore. We know that we're in this for the long haul. So it's going to be, you know, tiresome work. It's going to be exhausting. And I think everyone that's involved, they're fully aware of that. I think what we really need is just more support. Of course, resources are great. We need more resources. We're trying to actually build wells in some of the neighborhoods so folks can have free water outside of government when something like this happens again. And so having people with that one, with the knowledge, having people with the power, having other folks come in from across, you know, the region or even the nation to say, okay, we can help lend a hand, we can provide some of these services has been really helpful, will continue to be helpful, and it'll give some of us time to rest. So yeah.
Well, first of all, I wanted to just say that usually whenever I go out to speak, I usually end it, I try to end it in my speeches, but always remember to enjoy what you're fighting for. Not just rest, but enjoy your life. I mean, you're fighting for it, live it, you know? So I always try to tell people that. But I'm really, that whole thing about the well project has piqued my curiosity. What is that process? What is it that you are doing? And how the heck can we help? I would definitely like. Can you hear
me? This is something that is kind of that I won't say it's new. Yeah, people have been doing this work for, you know, again, years. But something mm-hmm. that the coalition or collective of folks that are doing this rapid response that we were talking about. We have someone who has already started doing this work. They have a camp, and they were able to, it's a youth camp actually, and so they were able to put a well in rural Mississippi and Port Gibson, Mississippi. I went Saturday to check it out to kind of learn about what that process is, what it looks like. We are working on getting a budget together to see how many wells that we can do and exactly where, prioritizing, you know, the most impacted areas. So we're looking to put a well in kind of like Southwest Jackson area. That's an area that's still without water. At least, you know, some pockets in those areas are still without water. Anyway, again, new process. I am a country girl, but I do not know anything about like wells or any of that stuff. So we are all in a learning stage right now. We have some work days, some political education coming up. And then also, we don't just want to do things that the community isn't asking for. So we also have to do some organizing and to really ask and really get the community's buy-in. And I mean, not even get their buy-in, but like really let them take the lead on what they want this to look like. But I will say it is in the works. We are also kind of working with urgency because people are going on 4 weeks without water at all. So we want to go ahead and do this, even if we can only do one for the time being. We want to go ahead and at least get one well in, and then we might start, you know, we'll do more as possible.
And you have to do this amid the COVID crisis, which, you know, some people are saying that it's winding down for a little bit. But I think I'm concerned about, just like in Texas, Mississippi decided to open up everything. And how is what do you see that complicating your efforts in any way? Do you see people getting concerned about being sick and not wanting to come out, or see people actually getting sick as you're trying to do this work? What has it been like in that regard?
Yes, I would say the simple answer is yes. We are trying to be safe. Also, it's about to be some little girls in my backseat, so sorry.
It sounds like it.
We are trying to be as safe as possible. We're still following COVID-19 protocols as we are delivering meals and food and water and all of those many things. But then at the same time, you know, we have, especially the elderly, we want to make sure that they are safe. They have concerns. And we, you know, the governor lifted the mask mandate, which will complicate things in some ways, especially if numbers begin to surge again. But we also know we can't stop doing the work. So we just have to be as safe as we can be.
All right. Cool. Now, here's the thing that I really think that we need to ask. How can we help? Who can we reach out to? Who do we need to talk to? What can we do outside of Mississippi or even the South for that matter? How can we help? How do we reach out?
Yes. So a couple of ways. One, folks who are still impacted by this, we are still in need of resources. Again, we are trying to figure out what next steps look like. So we are getting water to people. People have donated water from all over. But now we're getting into folks have trees that fell on their houses, bursted pipes. There are people who have had to stay in the hotel for the last 2 weeks because of bursted pipes. So we're going to always need money. Just to be, you know, to keep it simple. We're going to always need money, going to need donations. Outside of that, again, we need people to give their time and their talent. If folks have the knowledge on how to be sustainable, how to do solar energy or build a well and make sure that people are able to get water, all of that knowledge is necessary and wanted right now. We also could use some help for folks who are in the area or folks who don't mind helping out as far as like being on the ground. We definitely need more volunteers. So we need physical volunteers to be on the grounds, making deliveries, again, helping us with some of these larger efforts that's putting gardens and wells in neighborhoods. But then we also need volunteers who can volunteer from anywhere. And those are people who will be making wellness calls. Early on in the storm, we had some very heartbreaking stories where there were elderly people found in their homes because they weren't able to get out. And so I feel like if we had people, you know, we've already made over 30,000 wellness checks, but we still are in the process of making more and just calling and making sure that people are okay and that they're taken care of.
And this is the work that you're doing, by the way, via the Black Youth Project, BYP 100. And a lot of people are familiar with that organization and the kind of really positive work that they do and they have been doing for a number of years now. You want to talk since you're a rep of BYP, could you explain to everybody what the Black Youth Project is?
Yeah, so Black Youth Project 100 is actually a national organization. It was started around the time when the trial for George Zimmerman after he was acquitted for murdering Trayvon Martin. And so this is a group of Black organizers 18 through 35 who organized through a Black queer feminist abolitionist lens. Black Youth Project 100 is just one part of a collective of many folks who are on the ground doing this work in Mississippi right now. But yeah, that's it. And our Jackson chapter has been really involved in a lot of the work that's happening.
And it's important, like I said, it's important work. And you mentioned George Zimmerman, and we are talking about this was forged out of basically trying to protect ourselves from those people that are supposed to be protecting us ironically enough. And I like how it has gone from just being out there and just trying to deal with the dealing with bad police and all that, and the elements that fuel them, into just saying we are going to build our community up with these kinds of with this coalition that we have built, that we have created. But having said that, it is still an issue in all over the country what we have to deal with when it comes to the police and when it comes to the aggression that is aimed directly at our communities. And again, it's kind of like radio silence when it comes to states like Mississippi in this regard. Now, I do recall that there were some things going on in Jackson. When I was down in Tupelo, I even saw things going on. And but last summer, I didn't hear much coming out of Mississippi. And I think now's the perfect time to talk about how did y'all respond to what was going on over the summer, and what do you have planned for 2021? Because as we start trying to network a little bit better as people, it's really good to know just where everybody's heads are at all over the country. And this is a perfect chance to just tell everybody what's going on in Jackson, what's going on in Mississippi in regards to dealing with the police, dealing with whether or not we should either defund or abolish or what have you. Where is everybody at in Jackson on that?
So, yeah, good question. I will say that last year there was probably one of the biggest protests in Mississippi in quite a few years, and maybe even decades. Over 4,000 folks showed up. But not a whole lot has happened since that protest. Again, Black Youth Pride, BYP 100, we are an abolitionist organization. And so we had some other efforts. We have been showing up at city council meetings. We have been JPD, which is Jackson Police Department, like many other police departments across the South and even the nation. Our local governments received CARES Act dollars from the first stimulus bill. So also outside of my organizing work, I'm a policy analyst and economic justice policy analyst. I've been following COVID relief funds for a while now. And what we saw even last year was that COVID CARES Act money from the very first stimulus bill went to police departments or local sheriff departments across the nation. Jackson is no different. And so Jackson gets, you know, termed this radical city when just truth being told, and BYP 100 is going to always tell the truth, is that we're not a whole lot different. And that cries to defund the police or abolish the police are not taken well in our city or at our city council. Since last year, since that large protest, there has been efforts by city council, and they have passed to arrest people and then not only arrest them and jail them in the city, but to also they have given money to surrounding cities. So basically to arrest people and then evict them out of the city. BYP 100 and others have shown up to, you know, express our concerns with this. And then also say that there are other ways that we can keep our community safe. And for folks who are not familiar with the history of Jackson and our surrounding cities, is that white flight happened in Jackson. Again, not a different story from a lot of places across the nation, but white flight happened. People began to move to the surrounding cities. Surrounding cities were developed. Now there's this narrative that the surrounding cities are a lot safer and Jackson is just crime ridden and violence is everywhere. What I like to tell people is when you look at those surrounding cities, it's not because they have more police officers, because they don't. My parents live in Brandon. It's because they have more resources. Those cities have people in those cities are able to, they have jobs and they have community centers and they have fully funded education, and that we just don't have that. We have crumbling infrastructure in Jackson. And so when BYP 100 talks about abolition, we're basically just talking about a safer community and a safer world. And that looks like clean water. That looks like infrastructure that's not crumbling. That looks like fully funded schools. And so we're going to continue our mutual aid efforts and our rapid response efforts in response to the winter storm. But that's going to be tied into our other efforts around what it means to actually keep the community safe and to keep the community safe beyond policing. So what does that look like? What if our communities had access to food, to nutritious food? What if they had not only affordable housing, but quality housing to where they weren't on the streets? What if people, you know, had clean water? What if they had money to where they didn't have to worry about if they were going to have to pay an energy bill or pay rent for the next month? If our communities had all of these things and they were thriving, we know that we would see a decrease in violence, because we know that systemic poverty plays into the violence that we see in our communities. And so that's what we're going to be working on over the next year. We'll be showing up. We'll be holding elected officials, not only on the state and federal level, but also on the city level. We'll be holding everyone accountable. If you're in office, We want you to also have a plan to keep the community safe beyond policing. Jackson recently, within the last couple of years, they acquired a surveillance system. They call it a real-time crime center. It's basically just a surveillance system. It was initially put in the majority Black and brown parts of town. So what if, instead of putting that surveillance system in that community, we actually put, you know, new infrastructure, so folks would not be without water right now. So these are conversations that we're going to continue to have. These are things that we will continue to work on. We'll, again, continue to show up where we need to show up. And, yeah, that's it.
Christian, thank you.
Yeah. She just dropped it all there. I guess I would just say, Calandra, like, what was the response from the community and surrounding communities? What was it like following the summer and the George Floyd protest? Did you see more support? Was there more pushback? What was the large effect from outside communities?
Well, one, I would say that people all over after last summer were really looking for a political home. People wanted to get engaged. They wanted to know what could they do. And while we all did not have the same goal, we knew that something, and community folks, they knew that something needed to happen or something needed to change. And so that's something that we encountered. Other responses were, people thought defunding the police was just a little too radical. They did not want, you know, they did not want to bring that message to the city of Jackson. They didn't think that other community people would catch on. And of course, we all know if we're going to, you know, ask for something, we're going to need the power of the people. We're going to have to build base in order to do that. And so other folks that we are, you know, in coalition with just did not think that was the right message to bring at the time. I have my own thoughts about that. I think defund the police is actually a watered down message of what we actually want to happen. And so we are basically, you know, we're still organizing around this. This isn't something that's going to happen overnight. I'm also like trying to parent at the same time. We're organizing.
I got you.
We're organizing with people, and we're talking, and we're still providing political education to make sure that folks know that that a better world is possible.
Can you tell us how we can find you? I mean, I know where to find you on Twitter, but I'll let you tell everybody.
Yes. So I unfortunately do not have like our collective email and stuff in front of me right now. But I can give mine, and then I can always put people, plug you in, and to, you know, get you connected to the right people. If you're interested in food, we have someone over there interested in water, or interested in doing, you know, more sustainable work, then I can plug you into the right people. So I'll start with my Twitter handle, which is the @ and then it's Kalan, C-A-L-A-N, and then K-D. And then my email address, which is my name. So it's KalandraKD89@gmail.com.
All right. All right. Right. And by the way, I work with a crew called the Anti-Fascist Unity Coalition. We are around nationally, and we've been around for like 2 years. But what we've been doing over the past couple of months, every first Saturday, we do we set up food drives in various locations around the country. And our thing is donate food to your local mutual aid, to your local pantry, to your local food bank or what have you. And we just set up a donation spot, and that might, and if Mississippi wants to jump on board, if BYP 100 want to jump on board, but that's just basically donate food. Remember, it's on the first Saturday of every month. This is going to be Easter Sunday, and we would love to have you, and we would love to have other parts of the country, and especially the state of Mississippi, getting involved in this. So here's my public invitation to you. If and let's talk about this more. I want to tell you right now. I mean, Christian, do you have anything? Brian, do you have anything to say before we cut out?
I would just ask if there's a wall of shame, because we know that the governor of Mississippi has dropped the ball. We know that the lieutenant governor has dropped the ball. Is there any other particular political leaders that you can name, you know, by name, that are, you know, getting in the way of Jackson getting the help they need?
So I want to say yes and no, because there's city council members who have been on the city council for decades. But at the same time, I know that it's not really, now the governor, Tate Reeves, the lieutenant governor, definitely got in the way. There was a decision that could have been made 3 weeks ago that could have got people federal help. On the local level, the reason I don't want to call names is because I know that this problem has been, and it's really not, I want to hold people accountable. So I want to say that. But I also want people to walk away knowing that it wasn't this administration or just, you know, this particular city council, that this problem has been around for so long, and that the real history of it is really the structural and institutional racism, from redlining to just all of those things played a part into what we're seeing now. And then the neglect of the state to the capital city, and that neglect being because it's a predominantly Black and Brown city.
Wow, that's a great answer. Thank you.
Yeah. I guess I just have one quick rapid question, because when COVID is over, and thanks to, you know, some of our sponsors and donors around here, I'm hoping to get out and do some journalism out there in the world. And one of the places I've always wanted to visit is Jackson, Mississippi, because of all the history there and the current movements that are going on there. When I get there, what restaurant do I go to, and what do I like food in Jackson, Mississippi?
Okay, so what restaurant and what else? What was the second part of the question?
What do I order? What's the best food? What's the best place to go sit down and eat in Jackson, Mississippi? And what do I get while I'm there?
Oh, so there's so many places. I guess it really depends on. Now, we have a spot that everyone is loving these days. It's called Godfrey's. It's,
Godfrey's.
Yeah, you get, you know.
Yeah, no. I have family that brings it up. I have family in Alabama that brings up Godfrey's.
I think I've read about it in like a foodie magazine or something.
Yeah, they're the truth. You can get some great jerk chicken and soul food all at the same time. Also, Big Apple Inn is a Jackson staple, and you can get these nice smoked sausage sandwiches that are really like greasy but good.
I'm a diabetic, so I shouldn't be messing with that stuff, but I will.
I'm not, but I will be after I visit Jackson, Mississippi.
Here it's right now. My doctor just ran off the roof by me saying that, but Listen, I just want to say, man, now we lost Christian. I just want to say, Calendra, thank you very much for being here today. You dropped a lot of truth. You definitely opened up a lot of eyes, and they're going to stay open, and we're going to work together in the near future. So let us stay in touch. Let us stay in touch, and let's work something out, because Mississippi does need help. This is not to discount what's going on in Texas. Texas needs help too, but Mississippi, no one's been paying attention to. And I think it's about time we stop ignoring all the trouble spots. We solve one problem, another problem's waiting in the wings. Let's try to deal with them all at the same time. We can do that. And I want to thank you for coming on and basically making that clear to us. So.
Yes, thank you. Thank y'all for having me. Thank y'all for putting up with all my technical difficulties.
No worries.
Thank you.
It was fantastic. Thank you for taking the time.
All right.
Thank you.
Till next time. Talk with you then.
All right. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye, y'all. So that was enlightening, to underscore a fact. That was real enlightening. And I think we got to do that again. We got to have her on again. I mean,
she was good. That was great.
Yeah, because we got to keep up on what's going on down there. We do have to keep up with that. So
I was amazed that she stayed so on point, because you could hear everything going on. Like she was driving, picking kids. Kids were celebrating. They were watching. They were in a game in the background or something. But she was focused, man. She managed to keep it together. And man, I would have been like, shut the fuck up. So anyway,
She comes from the land that gave us Fannie Lou Hamer. All right. Yeah. So if you come from that, you know how to multitask. You know how to multitask, because everybody will go to work and put in work at the same time down south. That's why the civil rights movement was so successful. They knew that we were doing something in every aspect down that way, down in Mississippi, down in Alabama, down in Georgia. So yeah, much love to everybody. That's the legacy. That's some legacy activist work, you know. So that's why she was able to do that. We have a tendency of being detached up here in the north. This is what we do, and that's it. Well, not you, Brian, because you got five boys. So you can't be detached.
No, but well, I mean, we are in the middle of the woods with five boys, so there's somewhat of a detachment.
Yeah, but
our nearest neighbors are a pack of coyotes. I mean,
there you go. Your sons had to hunt the coyotes.
Yeah, but those boys right there, when they get older, they're gonna be a part of that revolution. They're gonna tell stories about him, them.
Yeah,
but their father being the guru of it all.
Oh man.
Yep, man. Well, we're getting ready. We're getting ready.
Talk about superpowers.
Yeah,
that's what they'll call them, the superpowers. All right, so we better start running it down and let everybody know how to find us. Christian, all right. Start.
Well, I mean, everybody knows where to find me. I'm at Perez Podcast on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook, Christian Perez, Modernity and Absurdity on YouTube. I started uploading some videos on YouTube. People want to hear me complain all on my own. All right, you can find me on YouTube, Modernity and Absurdity. And every Tuesday night, I'm here on the Ida Vox Report. Glad to be a part of the team.
Right. Oh, you're
tomorrow night, NJRR Live, we're going to host Lark Lowe. She's going to talk about racism in writing. Racism's everywhere in America. We know this, but she's been a writer, experienced it, written about it, done it all. So Lark is a great. She's going to be on. Plus, we're going to review a horror movie called The Platform from an anti-capitalist perspective with one of our editorial board members, Marilyn. So I can't wait. That's going to be 8 p.m. If you're watching this, you'll be able to watch it in the same place tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Revolution Radio's network.
And as for me, I should tell you, basically, you can reach me at D. Lamont Jenkins on Twitter and on Instagram. Of course, One People's Proj on Instagram, at One People's Proj, at Idavox OPP on Twitter. One People's Proj is also on Twitter. OnePeople'sProject.com, Idavox.com. And I, by the way, I actually have the guest for this week. I think, am I losing you or not losing you? I'm actually, we actually have the guests already set up for next week. We're going to have, there is a book, and I'm going to have the review for this book either tonight or tomorrow on idavox.com. It's been a busy couple of days, long story. It's called, it's a children's book called Color of Play. And this book, I'm going to do right now, it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. It's yes, it does address diversity, but it doesn't stop there. It goes beyond what we usually talk about when it comes to diversity. And we're going to have the author of that book, Nakia J. Howell out of Chicago, on the program. And I got a lot of questions because I highly endorse the book. Let's just say it like that. So that's next week. And like I said, there's going to be a review on it either tonight or tomorrow. I apologize for the delay, but it's just been insane. And I won't get into it right now because I can't. But in any case, I want to just wish everybody well. I will talk with y'all next week. I hope you guys have a great rest of the week. And until then, the Idavox Report is done. Peace!